Campus FM presents the second part of Professor David Cooper's talk entitled Meaning, Language and the Understanding of Cultures.
I think there are one or two people here who weren't here yesterday, so I'll very briefly, you know, do a resume of what I was talking about yesterday. You know, what I want to do in these sort of two lectures is, you know, address issues about meaning in the context of sort of anthropological understanding of sort of other cultures. And I began with the question of whether anthropologists and other social scientists need in their inquiries to invoke and employ the idea of meaning, and despite what certain so-called positivists and behaviorists and others have said, I concluded that yes, the notion of meaning is indispensable in social scientific inquiry. A very important part of that inquiry is precisely to try to identify the meanings and significance that words, gestures, rituals, practices have for the peoples being studied. So I then turned to the question, well, as it were, what is meaning? How should we understand the notion of meaning? And, you know, what I did in the sort of second part of yesterday's talk was to look at two very well-known approaches to the notion of meaning, and argue that neither was adequate. One was the view that, roughly speaking, meanings are sort of mental items inside the heads of speakers or agents. And the other view is that, you know, to grasp the meaning of anything is really to identify some rule which governs it. So, for example, to understand a word in a language is to understand the rule which determines how it'll be used. And I argued that that was sort of too narrow a view. Language isn't rule-governed to the degree that that approach would indicate. Right, so that's, I think, where I'd got to. And, you know, what I want to go on to now, having criticized two approaches to the notion of meaning, is to, you know, suggest to you a more adequate way of characterizing meaning. That is, what I'm looking for is some sort of general characterization of what it is that we're looking for when we look for the meaning or significance of any item, be it a word, an utterance, a gesture, a picture, a ritual in some ceremony, or whatever. I mean, what are we looking for when we ask about the meaning of something? Well, I mean, my suggestion is, I hope, you know, a fairly sort of simple one. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, something is meaningful, has meaning, when it's suitably related to something either larger than itself or beyond itself. And I suggest, you know, the word appropriateness as a sort of general name for this relationship. In other words, you know, to inquire into what a word or a gesture, say, means, is to ask how that word or gesture is appropriate. Appropriate, for example, for expressing a feeling, or for contributing to some whole of which it's a part, as in the case, say, of some phrase in a piece of music. or for ensuring the correct performance of some practice. I mean, for example, you know, to understand some move in a chess game, to understand the significance of the move, is to understand, at least in part, how that move contributes to the correct playing of the game of chess. Sometimes, when we're trying to identify or explain how a word or whatever is appropriate and therefore meaningful, sometimes we'll mention things going on in the head or mention rules which apply to the item, but not always. That's why I argued yesterday it's too narrow, too constrictive to think of meanings as ideas in the heads or as rules. There are two things I want to stress very strongly. I mean, first, there are just many, many ways in which something can be appropriate to some wider context, to something beyond itself. And therefore, there are many, many types or modes of meaning, many, many different ways in which items, words, gestures, pictures can be meaningful. And I want to stress as well that any given item, for example, a particular utterance, can be appropriate to or for all sorts of different things at one and the same time, and therefore have different kinds of meaning at one and the same time. I mean, for example, supposing we're in a restaurant together and I order some fish. The fish is served, I look at it and smell it and say, the fish is off. No, it's not fresh. Well, that's a very appropriate utterance, isn't it, for referring to and describing a certain item, a piece of fish, and it's being stale. It's also a very appropriate utterance for expressing my feeling of disgust at what's been served up to me. It's also an appropriate utterance for getting you, my fellow diners, to order something other than the fish, or not to take a mouthful of it yourself. And therefore, you know, we can speak of that utterance as having various different kinds of meaning. And philosophers and linguists have sort of invented names for those kinds of meaning. Descriptive meaning, expressive meaning, dynamic meaning, and so on and so on. And what I'm suggesting is that, you know, we understand those different, as it were, kinds or modes of meaning in terms of the different ways that utterances or gestures and so on, the different ways in which they can be appropriate to this or that. The question I want to raise at this point is the following. Can you say anything useful or interesting about what, in general, something has to be appropriate to in order to be meaningful? And it might seem that the answer is going to be no. I mean, some things are appropriate to this, some things are appropriate to that, and so on. Some gestures, for example, are appropriate for insulting people, others are not. But I want to say something like this, and this is going to be important, as we'll see, for, as it were, implications for anthropology. I want to say that, you know, ultimately, in the final analysis, it's to a whole form of life, a total scheme or context of cultural practices that words and gestures and so on need to be appropriate if they're to have meaning. And the term form of life, and sort of Lebensform, I think was coined by the sort of 19th century German philosopher and social scientist Wilhelm Dilthey, but is best known perhaps because of, for the way in which it was taken up by sort of Wittgenstein. And Wittgenstein, and the point I'm making here, I think, is a very Wittgensteinian one. I mean, Wittgenstein himself says, you know, ultimately to understand, for example, judgments is to understand their place in a whole form of life. Now, I stress terms like, you know, expressions like, you know, in the final analysis, something's meaningful because of its relation to a whole form of life. Because, of course, in everyday communication, when we're trying to explain something's meaning to somebody, we don't have to describe a whole culture or form of life. This relates, I think, to a question that was asked yesterday. But that's because, isn't it, in normal everyday situations, we can take it for granted that each of us has an implicit grasp of, as it were, the culture, the form of life in which we're participating. We don't need, therefore, to spell it out. So, for example, if I'm trying to explain to, a child the significance of some particular ritual in a Catholic church ceremony, I probably won't need to explain to the child what churches are, what religion is, and so on, because the child probably already has at least an embryonic understanding of all that, simply through having been brought up in a culture where there are churches, religious practices, and so on. But here you should, you know, try and remember to put yourself in the position of so-called radical interpreters, who I mentioned yesterday. That is, people who are not entitled to any kind of assumptions about the cultures or forms of life they're encountering. When you're in the position of a radical interpreter, it does become crucial, if the meaning of something is going to be explained to you, to get some understanding of the whole culture, which may be entirely alien to you. There's in Father Peter Saracino Inglot's book, he has a nice little discussion of this, which I think he's taking up a point made by Joe Frigieri in a book of his. And what Father Peter says is that if you're in a very alien culture and you're, as he puts it, left out, cut off, isolated, for example, at an African cattle market, or a Japanese tea ceremony, or perhaps a rugby game between England and Scotland, you're just not able to understand what's going on. And that's because you don't have a kind of overview or grasp of the general culture or form of life in which these practices are being conducted. You don't, in my terminology, have a sense for what is and isn't appropriate to say or do. You go into the Japanese tea ceremony and you don't know what to do. You feel clumsy and alien. ditto at an African cattle market, and so on. You don't know what would be relevant, what would be appropriate. And therefore, if you want an explanation of what's going on, you probably will need an informant who can tell you about the general culture to which those practices belong. And imagine trying to explain baptism to, you know, say, a Martian visitor or a tribesman from the Brazilian jungle. Here, to explain adequately what baptism is, you would have to give the Martian or the tribesman a sort of feel or grasp for the whole religious culture in which baptism has its particular place. Now I want to get back to sort of issues of anthropology in the light of what I've just been saying. So I even look like an anthropologist today in my sort of David Attenborough outfit. And the particular issue I want to focus on is, you know, I think a very central one to anthropology, and one which has been around at least since the 18th century, and not just to anthropology, to philosophy as well. And this concerns, you know, just how different it's possible for cultures or peoples to be from one another. In the 18th century, I mean, the great Scottish philosopher David Hume has an interesting passage where he says, look, you know, all these travellers' tales which we're hearing about amazingly bizarre societies in the South Seas or wherever, and about the bizarre, strange beliefs and practices in those societies, well, we can dismiss those travellers' tales. There is, says Hume, a uniformity in human nature, and therefore there are definite limits on how different human beings in their beliefs and practices can be from one another. Everyone who shares in human nature must be sharing, at least to a very considerable degree, beliefs, ideas, values, and so on. So this is a kind of sort of a priori dismissal of the idea that there could be really serious, incommensurable differences between societies. But of course, many later anthropologists have insisted that there are cultures which are incommensurably different from one another and from ours. The pioneering anthropologist Lévi-Brull, for example, you know, argues that there are traditional societies in which there operates what he calls a sort of pre-logical mentality. And by this, he didn't mean that, you know, the people in these traditional societies were just stupid. You know, they hadn't, as it were, reached the stage where they could reason. He meant, I think, that they just operated according to quite different patterns, or if you like, laws of thought from those of logic as we're familiar with it. And any number of other anthropologists, you know, wanted to argue that in Africa or wherever you can encounter belief systems which are, so to speak, unintelligible in our lights. And could it be, for example, this is going back to one of those Karen Blixen examples, could it be that, you know, the members of a culture, in this case the sort of Kikuyu culture of East Africa, could it be that Kikuyu just don't regard other people, Westerners and Europeans in particular, as human persons at all, but as mere natural phenomena, as Blixen put it, like the weather. Or, to take another example, this time from West Africa, could it be that people in West Africa, as we're sometimes told, really believe that all the events in dreams, all the events we dream about, are actual, real, actual events? Because they take place in another world, which the dreamer, or the soul of the dreamer, visits during the night. So when I wake up in the morning, recalling my nightmare, on that belief system, I didn't dream this, it all actually happened. Not, of course, as it were, on this earth, but to the world that my soul traveled to and visited during the night. Pretty unpleasant world, as it has so happened. Well, you know, issues like this, I take it, are interesting, and of course it's these sort of issues which feed into the whole debate about sort of cultural relativism. I think there are different species of cultural relativists, but at least one kind of cultural relativist, I think, argues like this, and he or she says, look, the truth, value, rightness, these can only be relative to particular cultures or forms of life. They're not universal. And that's because differences between cultures or forms of life can be so gross that basically those cultures are incommensurable. There's no common scale or measure by which we can sensibly adjudicate which system of beliefs or values is the more acceptable. Two sort of modern Western psychologists could have a sensible argument about which is the correct interpretation of some dream, a Freudian interpretation, a Jungian one, or something else. But imagine the Western psychologist having a debate with the Yoruba tribesmen, for whom dreams are a matter of having visited another world during the night. Well, that they've got no, as it were, common starting point, no basis on which they could, I think, sensibly discuss which was the correct account of my nightmare. Well, the question I want to raise in connection with this big issue is, how, if at all, might reflection on meaning help to settle the issue or debate? Now, a pretty plausible thought is this, isn't it? Given the inseparability of culture or a form of life from language, point I was trying to make yesterday, given the inseparability of a form of life from the use of language, then if there are radical, incommensurable differences between forms of life, this is going to show up, as it were, as radical differences in the languages spoken in the different cultures, in the range of meanings available to express in the languages of the respective cultures. So the plausible thought is this, that, the question, can there be radically different cultures, leads into the question, could there be radically different languages and, if you like, radically different conceptual schemes embodied in those languages? And this thought has, prompted a very well-known argument by the American philosopher Donald Davidson. The older among you may remember him coming to Malta some years ago to speak. When was that? 15. Yeah, anyone older than 15 may remember that. And Davidson presents the argument I'm about to mention in a paper called The Very Idea of a Conceptual Scheme. And what he argues in this paper, is that actually differences in beliefs and concepts can't be that big. There can't be languages that different from our own. So, the style of the approach here is very much like Hume's, saying, if you think about it, you can say straight off that the kind of radical differences which some anthropologists have proposed can't really exist. And Davidson's argument sort of goes like this. He says, look, suppose we're able, at least in a rough and ready way, to translate the native language into our own. We've got at least a provisional working translation of their language. And Davidson says, well, if we have, then there's got to be a hell of a lot in common between them and us. In fact, there's got to be a massive agreement between them and us in judgments and beliefs about how things are. If there weren't, we would never have been able to get going on the business of translation. And after all, if you, the interpreter, the anthropologist, find yourself attributing very bizarre beliefs to the natives about, say, the moon, then wouldn't that be a jolly good reason for thinking you've got the translation wrong? It's much more plausible to think you've got the translation wrong than that the natives are crazy. Or at any rate, you should entertain the possibility that you're taking their apparently very strange remarks about the moon too literally. You should recognize that they're speaking figuratively or poetically when they make these on the surface, strange claims about the moon. So, Davidson says, it's a sort of precondition of translation, of getting going on the business of translating another culture's language, that you attribute to the native speakers as many beliefs which correspond to ours as you possibly can. And that means that the differences between them and us in terms of beliefs can't be that big. Of course, it may be, Davidson says, that you can't even get going on the business of translation. Every attempt to translate the noises they make into English or whatever fails. But then, says Davidson, why would you suppose any longer that they are speaking a genuine language? They're simply employing a sort of signalling system like certain animals. And that's why any kind of translation into English never gets going. So, you know, what Davidson says is this then. Look, and either you can translate the noises the natives in this other culture are making, or you can't. If you can, they can't be so very different from you in terms of what they think and believe about the world. If, on the other hand, you can't translate what they're saying, then why assume that they're really saying anything? They're just making noises, albeit noises perhaps of the kind that sort of monkeys or leopards make as sort of signals. So it might be suggested, for example, to go back to the Blixen example again, in the light of the Davidson approach, it might be suggested that, look, you can't seriously suppose that the Kikuyu believe we Europeans aren't people at all. At least you can't think that if you think you've correctly translated their language and recognized when they're speaking literally rather than metaphorically. So if you find yourself, as Blixen was tempted to do, if you find yourself attributing to the Kikuyu the belief that Europeans, white people, are not people at all, then either you've mistranslated the Kikuyu language, or you fail to appreciate that they're not talking seriously or literally, they're talking figuratively. Well, what are we to make of, this attempt, this sort of, to, as it were, rule out radical difference in belief and meanings? I used to think it was more or less right. Now I don't. It's good to know one can change one's mind sometimes in philosophy. I want to give you raise a couple of considerations which I think, at the very least, call into question this way of trying to outlaw radical differences in belief, value, and so on. There's an assumption, isn't there, being made. I think made very clear by people like Davidson who take this approach, the assumption that where you don't understand another culture or find yourself attributing seemingly crazy beliefs to members of the culture, where this happens, then adequacy of translation must be the real problem and issue. If only you could get the translations right, you would understand what they were saying. You wouldn't be attributing bizarre beliefs to them. Well, I think that point, that assumption, does work quite well in the case of very simple, basic terms in languages. For example, supposing you've provisionally translated one of the native words as green, but you then find that the speakers apply green to things which are red and blue and so on. Well, you might say these people are crazy, that they think that red things are green as well. But probably you wouldn't, would you? You'd say, oh, we've mistranslated. That word, we thought it meant green, but it doesn't. Or, another real possibility. It does mean green, but on these occasions, it's not being used literally. I mean, after all, our word green has non-literal or extended uses, doesn't it? If you say somebody is green, you probably don't mean that they're a certain colour. You probably mean that either they're inexperienced or that they're sort of eco-friendly. And maybe that's what's happening in the case of the native language, when they call certain things which are not coloured green, green, they're not using their word in a literal sense. So, you know, this idea that where you start attributing bizarre beliefs to people, you've got to stop and realize you've got the translation wrong. But that sounds, you know, quite good, sensible in the case of terms like green. But I think when we turn to, sort of cosmological and religious beliefs, things like that, I think the situation's very different. It seems to me that beliefs of that kind in another culture can be unintelligible to us, even though we can be very confident that we've translated their language properly. So it's not adequacy of translation which is the problem. I mean, let me give a couple of examples. One I mention in the the book meaning. Think about Renaissance alchemy. I don't know how many of you are sort of familiar with the writings or views of some of the Renaissance alchemists. But if you are, I think you concede that their, as it were, way of thinking, if you like, their conceptual scheme, was very bizarre indeed. And almost impossible, it seems to me, for 21st century people to enter into and get a grasp of. And how could people, for example, have reasoned as follows? If somebody's got syphilis, they should apply mercury. You know, the substance mercury. Why? Well, because syphilis is usually contracted, or so it's held, in the marketplace. And marketplaces are, in the terminology of the time, signed by the planet Mercury. Well, it really seems to me a problem getting into that way of thinking. But I don't think this has got anything to do with translational problems. I mean, there's no problem in translating 16th century Italian or Latin into English or Maltese or whatever. We can be very confident, I think, that what these alchemists meant by their terms. We can also be confident, I think, that they were talking literally. They weren't talking poetically when they talked about mercury being the cure for syphilis. Or again, let's go back to the Blixen type example. Blixen herself, certainly plenty of her fellow European farmers, and of course lots of the Kikuyu she knew, knew one another's languages very well. Lots of them were probably bilingual. So there wasn't, a serious problem for Blixen in recognizing whether she translated the words of the Kikuyu correctly. I mean, she had, she knew the language very well, or could consult very reliable informants. So if there was a real problem, nevertheless, in making intelligible to herself the alleged beliefs of the Kikuyu, again, this is not because of a translational problem. It seems to me that in cases like this, the Renaissance alchemy case, the Kikuyu one, it's not so much that, you know, what they assert is something that we deny, and vice versa, that what they deny is what we assert. It's not really that a matter of disagreement between them and us. It's more, as I think the American philosopher Nicholas Rescher puts it, it's more that, you know, one scheme of thought is committed to something that the other doesn't envisage at all, that lies outside of its conceptual horizons. I'll just repeat that. It's not so much sort of differences in judgments between the alchemists and modern-day chemists, for example, which is the issue. It's rather that their scheme is committed to something that the other scheme doesn't envisage at all, that lies outside its conceptual horizons. And that seems to me pretty plausible. And and the second way I want to sort of call into question the sort of Davidson-style strategy for reducing or outlawing radical differences in beliefs and thought. And this concerns in particular the notion of metaphorical, or at any rate non-literal, meaning. And as we've seen, I think one approach when you're faced by apparently very bizarre beliefs that you're attributing to the natives is to say, well, of course, it's not exactly that we've mistranslated them. It's just that we haven't recognized until now that they're not speaking literally. And so these apparently very strange beliefs they give voice to are not really beliefs at all. They're just poetic or metaphorical ways of expressing something perhaps quite everyday. I mean, for example, I think I mentioned it briefly yesterday, if you're among the Zande people, one of them might say, right, I've got to go off and feed my dead ancestors now, feed the souls of my dead ancestors. And you might say, well, this is crazy. How can immaterial souls be fed? I mean, they don't have mouths or teeth. But then, of course, you begin to realize, well, you've got to take this in a sort of non-literal sense. You know, when they speak of feeding the souls of their ancestors, they mean something like putting food out as a way of honoring or showing respect for the souls of their dead ancestors. Problem solved. You're not attributing a particularly bizarre belief to them at all. Now, again, I think I want to say that, that kind of point works quite well in very simple cases. I mean, if you hear the natives, or indeed your own neighbours, calling someone a pig or a rat, you're very unlikely to say, hey, my neighbor's mad. He thinks that human beings are also pigs. No, what you do is, of course, is to assume that your neighbor is speaking figuratively, that in calling someone a pig, he means something like that person's a gluttonous, sloppy eater or something like that. You don't attribute to your neighbour the belief that a human being can, as it were, transmogrify into a pig. But again, it seems to me, once we turn to more interesting cases, to, as it were, sort of large-scale, systematic metaphors in languages, that, you know, these themselves may embody radically different ways of seeing the world or conceptualizing the world. In other words, by saying, oh, they're just speaking metaphorically, you don't, in fact, necessarily show that therefore they don't disagree with us, because it may be the very nature of the metaphors they're employing which shows the gap between them and us. I mean, when I talk of sort of systematic or organizing or root metaphors, as they're sometimes called, I have in mind sort of examples like this. If you think about it, our way of sort of metaphorically picturing the mind is very much, isn't it, of picturing it as a sort of a place or container. We talk of things being in the mind or out of the mind. We talk of minds being empty or full of ideas and so on. We talk of thoughts going through the mind. We talk of somebody expanding their mind and so on and so on. And I don't think it's too difficult to imagine, or maybe if one's read enough anthropology, actually find other organizing metaphors of the mind in other cultures, metaphors that might register a very different way of thinking about and conceiving of the mind from the ones suggested by our sort of container-like metaphor. For example, you know, I'm told that, you know, amongst some African peoples, the mind is, so to speak, metaphorized as something like the ocean, in which each of us, so to speak, dips for our thoughts and ideas. There aren't, as it were, separate minds, like separate containers, yours and mine and hers. There's mind with a big M, this sort of ocean of ideas, thoughts, concepts, in which each of us individuals, as it were, draws bucketfuls at appropriate times. And, you know, if this is so, I don't know enough about it, but, you know, it begins to sound as though here, in and through the very different metaphors that are being employed to picture the mind, a very different understanding of mind is being manifested. Another example, the way in which we metaphorize happiness. And nearly all our metaphors, figurative ways of talking about happiness, treat happiness as something which is up. The happy person is up, he's on an up, on a high, on top of the world, on cloud nine, and so on. Whereas the unhappy person is down, flat, deflated, depressed, in the abyss, even. And I think this corresponds, doesn't it, or embodies a rather particular and perhaps rather parochial Western notion of happiness. The happy person is sort of active, up and about, doing things, so on and so on. And I think our way of, as it were, metaphorizing happiness or symbolizing it, isn't at all universal. And it may be there are other cultures in which happiness is figuratively expressed in very different ways, and in ways which might indicate a very different understanding of happiness. For example, so I'm not sure what language they speak, but lotus eaters have a very different idea of ways of metaphorizing happiness. It wouldn't be in terms of the happy person being up and about, active, energetic. The happy person takes it easy, lies on a beach, under the palm trees, and so on. Well, who are these silly people who, mad dogs and Englishmen, who are running around doing things, playing polo and things like that? Silly. Okay, then, so I'm going to sort of wind up in, so to speak, 5 minutes and then have a break. What I'm arguing, then, is that there's no quick move that you can make from the natives are only speaking metaphorically here to the conclusion, therefore, their beliefs don't really differ significantly from ours. For what I'm suggesting is that there may be indeed radical differences between their beliefs, concepts, and ours, which are manifested in and through the metaphors themselves. It's the very metaphors which indicate a difference in conceptual horizons. And if that's right, and if the point, my previous point, is right, it doesn't seem to me that reflection upon translation, on the adequacy of translating the language of another culture, it doesn't seem to me that reflection of this kind can therefore sort of exclude in advance the existence of radical difference in meaning, thought, value, and so on. And as I see it, there's just no alternative in understanding the words, gestures, practices, rituals of another culture, another form of life. No alternative to coming, if only vicariously, to share in that form of life, that total context of practices and beliefs. For it's this to which meaning and significance are relative. What you need to do, as it were, to understand the words, gestures, so on, is develop a sense for what is and isn't appropriate to say in this or that context, what is or what isn't appropriate to gesture or to do in this or that situation. And that kind of sensitivity is something that's only going to be acquired through if only a vicarious participation in the form of life in question. And that leads me to a final remark. I just want to leave you with this. I think a possibly intriguing result of this discussion, even perhaps a paradoxical one. One of the great anthropologists of the 20th century was the sort of Oxford professor of anthropology, Evans Pritchard. And a lot of his work was done amongst peoples in East Africa, the Zande, the Nuer, and so on. And he found, in his writings about these tribes or peoples, he attributes to them some indeed very strange beliefs and mental capacities. rather like Levi-Brule. He thinks that you have to attribute to these peoples a quite different sort of logic from the logic which we think of as operating in sort of Western thought. And people would ask Evans Pritchard, do you understand these guys? I mean, if they have these sort of beliefs that you attribute to them, if they reason in those kind of ways, can you really make any sort of sense of them? And Evans Pritchard's answer was, well, yes, when I'm there. But as soon as I get back to Oxford, I can't. In other words, when I'm out there, you know, in the Sudan, joining in with their ceremonies, joining in their religious worship, eating communally with them, it all seems perfectly intelligible. But, you know, once I'm back in my study in Oxford, or dining at high table, or rowing on the river, it's all gone. Now, I think his point is, isn't it, the one I made just before, that, understanding may require a kind of sensitivity to what's appropriate or not, what's to be done, what isn't, what's to be said, what isn't. A sensitivity which is only, as it were, operating when you're there, as it were, in the field, amongst the people who you're trying to understand. And when you're taken out of that context, you have to return to a very different set of sensitivities and assumptions to now understand the people who you're with, at your Oxford College. And you have to forget, so to speak, about the Nuer and the Azandi, at least for a few months. So that's the sort of thought I'll leave you with. Maybe we can discuss it after the break.
You have just listened to the second part of Professor David Cooper's talk entitled Meaning, Language and the Understanding of Cultures.